The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We have shortages of poll workers, shortages of polling places, and shortages in material that you need in order to pull this off, and a complete inability on the part of election officials to plan for the voter flow, whether it's on election day or in the vote by mail process. And so I would say that I continue to remain alarmed about November, and a lot needs to change in the next 2 months.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 24th, 2020. It's been a while since we checked in on whether the election we are about to hold in the fall is going to be a disaster, but we thought it was time to do that. We've got COVID-19 still rampaging around the country. We've had a bunch of primaries in a bunch of different states that did not go as planned. And of course, there are the Russians who are lurking in the background. So we thought it would be a good week to check in with Nate Persily and Margaret Taylor. Nate is the James B. McClatchy Professor of Law at Stanford Law School, and he has been kind of the guru on conducting a safe and efficacious election in the era of COVID. And of course, Margaret Taylor is our own congressional guru and has been tracking what, if anything, Congress is going to do about any of this. They joined me in the Jungle Studio on Monday afternoon for a wide-ranging conversation about where we are, where we need to be, and how long the road is ahead over the next few months. It's the Lawfare Podcast, June 24th. Election meltdown update. Nate, I want to start by just having you update us on where things are with the ongoing process of ensuring that the election in November can take place amidst the coronavirus. The last time we talked, you had a lot of anxiety on the subject, as do a lot of other people, and there was a fair bit of policy movement in place at a bunch of different states regarding that. So bring us up to speed. What is happening and how confident should we be in the electoral process that is developing?
Well, since I was last on this podcast, we've had several primary elections to give us a little bit of a window into preparations for November. And what we've seen is not good. After the last time we spoke, we had the debacle in Wisconsin, which could have been chalked up to just political dysfunction and wrangling between the Democrats and Republicans there and last minute changes. But since then, we've seen problems in Georgia, even Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, and several other places. And so what we're seeing is that there are shortages of the relevant sort of people, places, and things that you need to run an election. We have shortages of poll workers, shortages of polling places, and shortages in material that you need in order to pull this off, and a complete inability on the part of election officials to plan for the voter flow, whether it's on election day or in the vote by mail process. And so I would say that I continue to remain alarmed about November, and a lot needs to change in the next 2 months.
When we hear Democrats talk about this issue, it is generally in the language of voter suppression. When we hear Republicans talk about this issue, it is often in the language of local officials' incompetence. You're describing a bunch of different states with very different attitudes toward, you know, how easy it should be for what sort of people to vote. And so how do you understand what the fundamental cause of the problem is right now?
In the primary elections, I do not think the story is voter suppression. I think the story is misuse and misallocation of resources, as well as just real difficult problems, unprecedented problems that these jurisdictions need to deal with. As we approach the general election, there's the kind of convergence of concerns about voter suppression with these resource allocation decisions as to, for example, how many, you know, polling places are going to be open in different parts of a state, whether the urban centers are going to get the resources they need, and whether, for example, there'll be challenges about mail ballots and the like. But right now, most of the problems that we see that are COVID related would not fit into the box of like voter suppression. It would be more dealing with the logistical challenges that these jurisdictions face.
And do you, when you said we have a lot of work to do over the next 2 months, why two? We've got 5 months to the election. I've kind of imagined that this would be a sprint to the finish to, you know, make this election come off in a fashion that does us proud. Is there some magic line that happens 2 months from now along the way?
Well, all of the major procurement decisions to get this election up and running have to be made in the next few weeks, actually. I mean, we're facing the same kind of competition among states in the election infrastructure realm that we've seen in the healthcare realm when it comes to ventilators and face masks and the like. And so I've talked to jurisdictions just in the last day or two that are only now contemplating buying all of the mail sorters and extraction machines and things like that that you need for vote by mail. And there are only a few firms that make those in the country. And all of these orders have to be in the next month. Then on the reason 2 months is the right time period to think about it, which is that you have to know where the polling places are going to be in order to inform voters in September where they're going to vote in November, as well as you need to know how many poll workers you're going to have at your disposal to then see whether you can staff the available polling places. And then finally, the actual polling places themselves. We are seeing a crisis around the country where senior living facilities, firehouses, and schools are closing themselves off as polling places. And unless the jurisdictions can find adequate substitutes in the next few months, they're not going to be able to plan for all the voter communication that needs to be sent out at the end of August and beginning of September.
So it's a real mess. And is this a, as you understand it, is this a 50-state problem, although I guess a small number of states have universal vote by mail, so they would be kind of already having dealt with this. But with those two or three states accepted, is this a universal problem, or is it a problem that afflicts particular known states?
It afflicts all of the states that do not have experience with vote by mail and now have to ramp up very quickly. And so, although you're right that there are five states that have universal vote by mail, Hawaii, Utah, Colorado, Washington, and Oregon, there are several states like California and Arizona that have had overwhelming vote by mail. So over 75% Arizona, well over two-thirds in California. So they are experienced in this area. But places like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin that have had only 5 or 6% of their voters cast votes by mail, or North Carolina, same thing. Then to move to a situation where maybe half of the voters are going to be casting votes by mail is a major logistical undertaking. A place like Florida has had a third vote by mail, a third vote early in person, a third vote in polling places on election day. They are also of the battleground states better positioned than others. But I would be focusing on the same states, unfortunately, that we're always focusing on in these elections, which is the Midwestern battleground states, and to see whether they're prepared.
And how much progress do you think has been made over the, I mean, we've been talking about this a lot over the last few months, and people noticed with Wisconsin with a lot of alarm and noticed Georgia with a lot of alarm. How much progress do you think has been made so far? Is it something that people are talking about, but not enough is happening or nothing's happening? Is it stuff where people are really doing a lot of work? How do you understand, given that the distance we've come is not far enough, how far we've come in real terms?
Well, I think right now the jurisdictions appreciate the problems. I mean, everyone is on notice as to what the problems are going to be. And so no one can complain that they weren't warned. Whether they get the resources they need is another question, either from the federal level or the state level. But I would say that we really don't know how prepared they are. And partly that's because we simply don't know how people are going to try to vote in November. And we've sort of overcorrected on the vote by mail issue, partly because of the president's tweets and the partisan polarization of vote by mail. That's where people are focusing their energies. But as we saw in Georgia, there are going to be tens of millions of people who, despite the availability of vote by mail, are going to try to vote in person. And so we need as much effort being put toward healthy polling places that are ubiquitous and accessible as we have with vote by mail.
So, Margaret, given the lack of state resources available these days for perfectly legitimate COVID-19 reasons, realistically, if there's going to be a major resource investment here, it's going to come from Congress. What is the state of congressional consideration of this issue? And to what extent can we expect a serious movement on this in Congress in whatever the next legislative package, resource-wise, COVID-19 response-wise, that Congress may entertain?
Well, just to go back a little bit in history to answer your question, last year, at the end of last year, there was a round of money, about $425 million, that was part of a larger omnibus appropriations bill. It authorized that money pursuant to a 2002 bill called the Help America Vote Act, which did establish some sort of substantive standards in the wake of the year 2000 Bush-Gore election debacle. That $425 million was a negotiation. The Democrats had wanted $600 million. Mitch McConnell in the Senate, Republican, wanted $250 million, so they compromised at $425 million. So that money is basically like money that is going as these block grants to the states to try to help, you know, fix bad voting machines and all the sort of basic types of election security stuff that goes on at the local level. Then again, in late March, there was another $400 million. Again, it's just sort of money that goes to the states pursuant to this 2002 law, another $400 million that was made available to the states to prevent, prepare for, and respond to the coronavirus for the 2020 federal election cycle. So that's what we've seen, you know, in the recent past on this. So, you know, they sound like big tranches of money. In reality, at various sources, including the Brennan Center, have said, you know, it's something on the order of $5 billion, really, that's needed to modernize elections in the states. So, you know, some money has gone. In terms of, you know, what we might see in a next round, I honestly don't know the answer to that question. But what I will say is that there's a real hang up between Democrats and Republicans on not necessarily the money. I actually think Republicans might be willing to provide more money if that seems like that's needed. It's on the substantive standards that states will be held to. So, for example, in connection with one of these COVID response packages that provided a bunch of money, Democrats wanted, you know, a requirement that states send each eligible voter mail-in ballots. But they didn't get that. The Republicans opposed that. So Democrats want some substantive standards to come into play here. Republicans, very opposed to that. They've been opposed to that this whole Congress ever since elements of that were included in H.R. 1, the very first bill that House Democrats passed. So I think you're going to see more of the fighting on the substantive issues. Now, I will just echo something Nate said, which is, I'm not actually clear that anything Congress could do at this point in time is really going, time-wise, going to be sufficient. So all of the things that the states are doing right now, they are testing equipment. They're having to really do the implementation phase. If Congress then suddenly comes in and makes a bunch of new standards, you know, it's not even clear to me, because we're so late in the game, how that would even play out. I mean, it could be actually quite chaotic.
Yeah. So first of all, Nate, who is right to the extent there's a Democratic, Republican substantive divide over standards, i.e. federally imposed standards, and that money may be held up for that fight? In your judgment, is it a good idea to end up in a standoff in which the money gets held up over these substantive standards, or is it more important really to get the money out the door to the states as quickly as possible, because you're operating on a ticking clock here?
Yes, we need to get the money out to the states as quickly as possible with as few strings attached to it. And I think that the political fight over vote by mail should not be the obstacle standing in the way of getting that money out the door. So I would say that, for example, if Congress simply wanted to expend the money with in-kind contributions in certain respects, that would be one way to defray the cost. So just the mail costs alone, right, just paying for postage related to delivering ballots and returning them, that would be many, many millions, and probably hundreds of millions of dollars. Second, if they were to defray the cost of paying poll workers, right? We have a huge poll worker shortage as a result of COVID-19. If Congress can't get the money together to deal with vote by mail, or they're worried about that, earmarking money for poll worker recruitment would be key. Third is the PPE and other supplies that are needed. Even if they were just to give it from the federal stockpile, every polling place in the country is going to need masks, gloves, and sanitizing, whether it's hand sanitizer or disinfectant for the machines, right? That needs to be provided, let alone opening up federal facilities as polling places and allowing individual, federal employees to get paid time off to serve as poll workers. There are certain things that you could do to relieve the stress on jurisdictions right now that would make a really big difference in November.
And Margaret, do you have the sense that approach is a non-starter for Democrats, that they want a vote by mail political resolution, and that's the absence of that is realistically a deal breaker for them?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I think Democrats recognize that, I think Nate's right. Like, where the rubber hits the road on this at this point is in the states and the localities. And so I do think a lot of energy is being focused on trying to get those states and localities up to speed on these things. It's just Congress, the way it works, they have their bills and they want to see their bills be passed that address these substantive standards. But unfortunately, there's just an impasse in Congress. So I do think there's it's like a two-handed ground game going on. One is pursuing things in Congress, but also, the Democrats sort of as a party, definitely, I think, trying to support the states in expanding vote by mail. I mean, I would just say it's interesting to watch a lot of the rhetoric plays out in Congress around these issues. So as you both know, President Trump has come out so strongly against the mail-in ballots. He just goes crazy on Twitter whenever, California or some other state pursues those measures. And so I do think that rhetoric has an influence on Republicans in Congress to sort of conform to that. And so it's on an issue where it's actually not clear to me if there was no president tweeting or having views on it, it's not clear to me that Republicans would necessarily sort of oppose that. But because you have the president out there so strongly on it, then they are inclined that way. And so it just really means like it's just not happening, like it's just not going to happen at the federal level. And at this point, you know, as we've said, it does seem like the energy should be focused on, you know, having the states use that money that the federal government has given them, making the most of it, you know, just pursuing as much as they can in the very, very short time that they have left before November.
So as you sort of go down the election administration hierarchy, the question of vote by mail gets much less political and polarized, so that local election officials of both parties have a much more management-centered approach to this and are in favor of vote by mail. Even at the state level in some places, take Utah, for example, you're not going to see Republicans, you know, aggressively opposing vote by mail. And so that's why my view is, you know, just get the money out the door and the locals will figure out a way to put it to its highest and best use. But if Congress, this is where I think the Democrats are being short-sighted, if that's the line that's being drawn in the sand, which is that they need polling places, right? We need to, if we just had $2 to $3 billion that was dedicated to polling place voting in November, that would make a huge difference in recruiting poll workers, in finding available polling places, and then getting the material that's necessary. And so the politics of our vote by mail should really not get in the way. And frankly, it's a lot of the Democratic voters, particularly poorer voters, racial minority voters, who are showing up in larger numbers in the polling places. And I think it would be in their interest to make sure that those are better funded.
Yeah. And just to be clear, you know, House Democrats, for their part, you know, they have basically said, you know, all forms of voting need to be available in November. Those include expanded vote by mail, significant early voting opportunities, safe in-person voting opportunities on election day. You know, they've said we need all three of those things. So it's just that I think the vote by mail sort of has come to a head in the coronavirus era, but they do seem to be focused on sort of just generally expanding access to voting as much as possible.
Right, because if we're going to have a fight about voting in an election year, we're going to have a fight about the whole subject rather than, you know, what's the acute problem that this year presents that other years don't necessarily present. So, Nate, you said we all know what the problems are going to be, and you ticked through a few of them. Do you have a sense of, leaving aside the five states that are all vote by mail or the major states that are substantially vote by mail, do you have a sense of like which states are handling the acute problem well? Is there like, when you look around the country, are there any states that jump out at you and like, wow, you know, if anybody's got a chance of really licking this problem, it's, you know, Delaware or Idaho? Like, you know, is there some secretary of state of some state who's really developing a bunch of best practices and communicating well with county election officials?
Well, I can tell you, I was on the task force that advises the Secretary of State in California on this, and it was an unprecedented group of people where you had the various interest groups and voter protection groups, as well as each one of the registrars of voters, you know, the election supervisors in the counties who participated. And then early on, they made a recommendation to move to as much vote by mail as possible. I mean, it's been called universal vote by mail, but every voter is going to get a ballot here. But as I said, the challenges in some of these non-battleground states, let alone ones that have had a long history of vote by mail, are just so much less than the sort of big five or six states that have that are the battleground states that have these big challenges. So no matter whether the problems are equally shared around the country, everybody's going to be putting a microscope on the familiar suspects here. Of those suspects, I have to say, Michigan has done, I think, a relatively good job here. Jocelyn Betson, their Secretary of State, has been quite aggressive. I've been impressed with what I've heard of Detroit. Wisconsin, I think it really just depends whether they learned the lessons of the primary. But, you know, the sclerotic partisan gridlock there is really going to affect Wisconsin's election administration more than others. I'm extremely concerned about Philadelphia, and this is not a partisan story. This is a resource allocation issue. I think Florida, from my discussions with the election administrators there, some of whom are really the best in the country now, having lived through baptism by fire several times over the last 20 years, is in a better position than I think historically it has been. But they will have, you know, the coronavirus cases there are going through the roof. And so we'll see how that affects their election administration priorities. But that's sort of a quick rundown of the areas that I've been talking about.
I was reading a few things and talked to a few people about this. So Iowa actually set a new record for its primary election turnout in May after the Republican Secretary of State there sent applications for mail-in ballots to all registered voters. More than 520,000 ballots were cast, which beat the previous record from 1994 of 450,000. After that, Republicans in the Iowa State Senate then essentially put forward legislation to prevent the Secretary of State from doing the same thing in the general election this November. They put forward a 30-page bill and a party line vote that would prohibit the Secretary of State from proactively sending those applications for mail-in ballots to all registered voters. And this was sort of baffling to the local authorities who were saying, you know, this is sort of crippling the process. And it was a successful process that they had in the primary. So I think the politics of this is getting sorted out in different ways in different places. And it'll be interesting to see sort of, for me anyway, in particular, how Iowa sort of sorts that out in the end.
Is there, in your judgment, an action plan that basically all states should be following? Or is this more particularized to local situations and that what is appropriate for one state is not necessarily appropriate for another? Or is this a situation in which you want to get as many people voting by mail as possible? You want to make sure there's as much early voting opportunity as possible, so you spread out the voting, and then you want to make sure there are as many polling places on election day as possible, and that formula is essentially universally applicable.
So that formula is universally applicable, but the challenges that jurisdictions face are specific to their context, whether it's technical and logistical issues or legal challenges. So for example, it is not as easy to recruit poll workers and to actually get them in the polling place in Philadelphia because of legal rules about what are known as election judges, which is their equivalent of a poll worker, that are actually elected officials. And so there are different states that have issues on procurement and union rules about how you get, you know, do these RFPs and the like. So there are lots of unique obstacles in each state. But the general problem is, how do you ensure voting with social distance? And the easiest way to ensure social distance is to have people vote at home. But barring that, have polling places that are plentiful and early voting locations as well, have them plentiful and designed in a way to ensure social distance and healthy voting. So the solutions at a high level, as we wrote in that in an article for the Lawfare blog, are quite consistent. But the challenges that different jurisdictions are facing are quite different.
Nate, everybody's been talking about vote by mail, and we've, you know, I think people like you have successfully directed a lot of politicians' attention to that issue, and rightly so. But at the end of the day, only, you know, X percentage of people under the best circumstances are going to vote by mail. And I'd be curious your thoughts about what X is realistically. But, you know, that leaves 100 minus X percent of people who are going to vote in polling places. And as you say, we have an acute shortage of poll workers. We have potential shortages of PPE. And we have all of this is set against an environment in which, particularly in urban areas, you end up with pretty long lines. So how concerned are you about the 100 minus X percentage of the population that is going to vote in person on election day under suboptimal conditions?
So roughly 35% of Americans were voting by mail in the 2016 election, depending on how you count. And so I would expect that share to go somewhere to 50 to 70% of Americans voting by mail, probably closer to the 50%. And so that leaves another, you know, 50 million to 75 million people who will be voting in some way other than mail. And that's early voting locations plus election day polling places. And I'm extremely concerned that our focus on vote by mail is now leading to resources being taken away from those polling places, which is what's leading to these long lines in the primaries and the like. In my view, the debate over vote by mail is actually over. We have all the states that people worry about in the battleground states have no excuse absentee voting for the most part. And so the political parties and the campaigns are now going to run their elections based on that. To be sure, there are places like Wisconsin that sometimes make it harder for voters to cast their ballot by mail, even when it's available. But the debate over its general availability is over, despite what the president might tweet. That being said, it's still a question as to how much the resources that these jurisdictions are going to be making available to vote by mail versus polling places. And there are large swaths of the population who simply, under no circumstances, are going to vote by mail. So there are a lot of people who, because of the recession following on COVID, have switched their addresses in the last few months. A vote by mail operation is only as good as the address list that you have. So you're talking about millions of people for whom really the only realistic way to vote is going to be to do so at a polling place. Also, there are just people who like the idea of seeing their vote drop into the ballot box, right? Whether sort of history of voter suppression or whatever, you see that. Then you have Republicans in particular who may have been attuned to the concerns that that Trump has expressed. And so they may not trust the mail and will be more likely to vote in person. We're seeing that in some pre-election polling. And so you're seeing a lot of different populations for different reasons show up in the polling places, and the jurisdictions have to dedicate the adequate resources to make sure that we have polling places, we have poll workers, and we have PPE available there.
Margaret, I want to close by reminding you of a time long ago in a far distant past when our principal concern about elections was, you know, foreign interference by these scary people called Russians. And you may remember this time. I know it was a long time ago. This set of concerns has been largely superseded by the logistical problems of running an election at all in a COVID-19 ecosystem. But they haven't gone away, and presumably the Russians are as or more capable of bad acts and interference as they were 4 years ago. How do these two sets of issues interact with one another? And are people in Congress who only very recently regarded Russian interference and potential other countries' interference as emergency problems, are they chasing the new shiny object or the new dangerous threat at the risk of losing focus on the old shiny object?
Well, it's worth, again, going back in time a little bit, just so we can understand how these things are being thought of now. So, as I said, you know, the first bill Democrats passed, it was kind of a big ethics and election and, you know, sort of democratic processes bill, high priority for House Democrats coming in early 2019. Obviously, that was never going to pass the Senate. It met a brick wall in the form of Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. What kind of happened after that was Senate Democrats in various forms either took pieces of that bill or had other sorts of ideas that were sort of discrete ideas, put them into bills, and then tried to get those through the Senate. So just as an example, one was called the Foreign Influence Reporting in Elections Act, which you may remember. This was a Warner bill, Senator Warner of Virginia. It was actually bipartisan with Senator Collins from Maine. It would have required presidential candidates to report illicit contact from foreign state actors, you know, to the FBI. So in other words, if a presidential candidate, the campaign is contacted by foreign state actors, that would need to be reported to the FBI. Of course, this ran into a huge buzzsaw with President Trump, who, you know, would be opposed per se to any sort of substantive legislation that would imply that he or his campaign did anything wrong in the 2016 election. The impact of that is that someone like Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is not going to take up a bill like that at all. And so that is where those types of bills have landed. It's really just kind of dead in the Senate. And what the Senate Democrats have done over the last sort of year and a half is they will periodically go to the floor of the Senate and ask unanimous consent to pass these types of bills, like even a package of three or one, or, you know, they've tried different combinations. Majority Leader McConnell, or he will have some other Republican senator do it. It's also often Marsha Blackburn from Tennessee, will come down and object to the passage of those types of bills. And just looking at how they talk about it, it's always been interesting. The last time they did this, the Senate Democrats tried to ask UC was in February before the coronavirus. They had done it a few times before, but, you know, a lot of rhetoric around it, not a lot of clarity from Republicans on exactly why they were opposing it. Sort of vague talk about federalism and this being a takeover of elections from the states by the federal bureaucracy, but never a really interesting or granular explanation of why they opposed it. But again, that the substantive explanation isn't all that interesting because there's not a lot of there. It's more this political problem that that Senate Republicans have because the president would oppose any such thing. In terms of where it goes from here, I mean, I suspect it's the same dead letter that it has been every time Senate Democrats go to the floor and try to get these bills passed. It's just not happening. It's not going anywhere. There have been some interesting discussions around sort of social media and the manipulation of social media, and more discussion, bipartisan discussions around that issue. So maybe we see something modest in that space, but it's hard to say. This issue, you know, I really think in Congress is pretty poisonous as among Republicans and Democrats and the president.
Can I say one thing here, which is that, you know, it is remarkable that, you know, we can be nostalgic for the time when all we had to fear was foreign takeover of the U.S. electoral system and voter targeted misinformation. But those problems have not gone away. And in fact, the epidemic actually exacerbates them. So there are new forms of disinformation related to the pandemic and vote by mail and the counting process and the like that are now available for foreign or domestic manipulation. And that on the sort of cybersecurity front, there's all kinds of new technology that's being rolled out in order to deal with voting during the pandemic that have not been tested and that really could also invite a cyber attack. And so all of the problems that we were dealing with before are now made even worse with the COVID environment. And just one last thing, which is that an election in which half the votes are cast by mail is simply a different kind of election than what we're used to. And because we may not know who the victor is on election night, it provides an opportunity for malicious actors to plant all kinds of stories about fraud in the process or about disputes with the balloting, so that if you are trying to run an information operation or an influence operation, that you have actually more fodder as a result of the virus and our adaptation to it.
Not to mention in the disinformation and information operations space, you have anytime you change the election operations rules, you have a lot of opportunity to misinform people about the new rules. So if people are going to vote by mail and you can say misinform them about how that process will work, you can probably get a bunch of people to do something that will disqualify them, like send their ballots to the wrong place, right? if you have a lot of changing locations of in-person polling locations or changing locations and times of early voting, you know, a little bit of misinformation can go a long way in getting people to show up at the wrong times or to the wrong places.
That's right. And I think that there's going to be a lot of sort of complexity that could be exploited by foreign and domestic misinformation actors as a result of the adaptations to the COVID environment. I mean, we're seeing it, of course, in our domestic conversation over fraud with vote by mail and the like. But as you say, even the actual mechanics of voting, where you vote and how you vote, right, are going to be new to people this election. And so it's an opportunity for malicious actors to really have an impact. I should say, this is one of the reasons why I am at least cautiously optimistic that some of the measures that Facebook has decided to take in recent weeks are at least pointing in the right direction, where they will amplify the voices of local election officials in order to try to counteract some of that disinformation. But we know that, you know, compared to, you know, national political campaigns, these local election officials are completely outmatched, let alone as compared to, say, you know, a GRU officer that's trying to stoke disinformation from a foreign location.
So on that cheerful note, we should wrap up. But is there, if you bring it all together in a kind of pithy summation, what's the message about what needs to happen over the next couple of months?
Well, there's something called the Election Administrator's Prayer, which is, oh, Lord, whatever happens, please don't let it be close. And so if it's a close election, all of these problems are going to sort of come from under the rock. And so we need to be operating on all fronts here, throwing as many resources as possible at vote by mail and polling place voting, getting poll workers, having polling places and the like. But, you know, if there's a large margin of victory for either candidate, then these concerns are going to go by the wayside. But right now, I think everybody's assuming that it's going to be a close or at least a contentious election down to the wire.
Nate Persily, Margaret Taylor, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Hey, I know I say this every time and you kind of tune it out, but you really should help us promote the Lawfare Podcast. We don't advertise. We don't, you know, buy space on other podcasts to toot our own horn. All we have to promote this podcast is you. So get out there and review and rate the Lawfare Podcast wherever you found us. Share us on Facebook, tweet us on Twitter, pin us on Pinterest, and upvote us on Reddit. I even think you should invent your own social media company in order to have a new venue in which to promote the Lawfare Podcast. You should buy Lawfare merch at thelawfarestore.com. And you should thank Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo, who is engineered this recording, and Jen Patya Howell, who as always produces and edits the Lawfare Podcast. Our music is, as ever, performed by the one, the only, the Beijing-based Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.